Game on 2FM.
With Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real.
Thanks to Jenny Green for her entertainment as always. It's Thursday the 27th of January and this is Game On. Coming up today, it's the one we've been waiting for. Katie Taylor is confirmed to put it all on the line against Amanda Serrano in Madison Square Garden.
This is what it's all about. This is why I'm involved in professional boxing, to be involved in the biggest fights possible. And like Eddie said, it's probably the biggest fight of female boxing right now. It's going to be the biggest fight ever of female boxing. So this is an absolutely historic fight. And it's great to be a part of such a big night. Yeah, Madison Square Garden, the mecca of boxing. I had the privilege of fighting there twice already as a pro. So to be involved in the biggest female fight possible in Madison Square Garden, the biggest and the most iconic stadium, that this is more than a dream.
Absolutely, I cannot wait. In Gaelic football, Austin O'Malley and Neil Ewing are with us to preview the start of the Allianz League. And in American football, we've Jeff Shepherd on the weekend's action. Will the Chiefs need to dig deep again?
It's going to be 49 yards is what it is. 49 yards to send it to overtime. Harrison Butker. I'm so nervous. So hundreds of thousands around the planet. The kick is good. It's going to overtime.
Plus, we've Winter Olympics, more AFCON and more transfer news. If you want to get in touch, you can text us on 51552 or tweet at GameOn2FM.
GameOn2FM.
Now, welcome along. Shane Dawson, Vorty Sport, is with me in studio alongside Austin O'Malley, former Mayo and Wicklow footballer. Austin, how are you?
Good Marie. Great.
Shane, keeping well?
All good. Looking forward to another evening of a lot of sport.
Anyway, enough about ye. I want to talk about Katie Taylor and nothing else. Such a huge, huge moment. So she is going to put her undisputed world lightweight title on the line against Amanda Serrano in a much anticipated showdown at Madison Square Garden on the 30th of April, which is a Saturday, and I tweeted a little bit earlier, I have checked flights. I am considering going. Gavin Casey is with us on the line from the 42. Gavin, I'd imagine you're going.
Yeah, my passport is on the missing list at the moment, Marie, but there's going to be a frantic search done around the house, I think, pretty soon. Do you know what, like, you guys know in studio there as well, to be able to talk about sport, to be able to write about sport as a job is pretty fun for the most part. But like, there are times when covering a sport like boxing can make you a bit weary as well, just with all of the politics and nonsense and bickering that goes on within it. And once this fight was confirmed this evening, I actually got goosebumps. You know, it was just one of those that reminds you of the privilege of the job, if I do get to go over and watch it from ringside or close enough to it. And it's just a legitimately brilliant sporting event, I think. Anybody who has even a casual interest in sport, not to mind boxing, it's sort of one for them, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. So look, give us a bit of context, right? It has taken a few years for this to come to pass, but it does sound like it's been worth it. What's the history between these two?
Yeah, they've been on a collision course ostensibly since Katie Taylor turned professional in 2016, because at that time, Amanda Serrano was sort of the woman in professional boxing. The only thing was, without the influx of talent from the Rio 2016 Olympics, and particularly without the ascendance of Taylor in the professional game, women's boxing at that time was not even an afterthought so much as it was not thought about at all. So it was almost a meeting of eras and ideologies in a way. Serrano was a fighter who has come up purely through the professional ranks, really, and Taylor has, as we know, has been an all-time great amateur. And her school, if you like, her kind of generation of amateurs were meant to come in and clean out the professional ranks, because they were supposed to have greater pedigree, greater training, and so on. And that has proved the case in most situations where they have met some of those more old-school pros. But Serrano was good enough that this is legitimately now a 50-50 fight, and it has been on the cards for 5 years, more and more, obviously, as Taylor's career progressed. You remember she fought Cindy Serrano, who's Amanda Serrano's older sister, was it the autumn of 2018? Might even have been 2017. And that fight was designed really to tee up a showdown between Katie and Amanda Serrano. And Amanda Serrano and her manager slash trainer, Jordan Maldonado, who's also her brother-in-law, he is married to Cindy, the older sister, have kind of dragged their heels on the fight for a number of years. I'd say Amanda Serrano has done a very good job of not taking the fight and finding reasons and even excuses to duck the fight. I once presumed that it was from a place of fear. Fear of losing, really, to somebody like Taylor, who to her mind is kind of a blow-in and is getting all of the attention that she has probably, that she feels rather, she is warranted throughout her career. The more I think about it, I think that was the case, but in more recent years, it's probably been more about trying to eke out every possible cent from the fight that she can and that Jordan Maldonado can. And that is their right. I mean, they're absolutely correct in doing it that way. And it's going to be the most lucrative fight in the history of women's boxing. And I think Taylor will probably surpass her earnings from the Delphine Persoon rematch in 2019, which to my understanding was somewhere in the region of $1.5 million. It'll probably be closer to two, I'd imagine, this time. And Serrano probably is looking at seven figures or close enough as well. So it has all culminated in this amazing spectacle, a headline event at Madison Square Garden. And for that reason, I'm a little bit glad that it didn't happen sooner.
So, Gav, where are they in their respective careers, do you think? Like, has Amanda improved an awful lot over those 5 years where she's dodged Katie? And just when you were, if you were to assess both of them and what they've been through over the last few years, who do you think is it better suited to do it now?
Serrano, without a shadow of a doubt. And the way I'd answer your question, Marie, is if I was to take you back maybe even 18 months or 2 years, I would have said that Taylor probably beat Serrano 8-2, roughly, and pretty much outboxes her comprehensively. I would have actually thought that it wasn't a fight of massive jeopardy to Taylor. I thought maybe fights like Persoon might even be harder. Now, we know as it transpired, both of those Persoon fights were incredibly difficult, but I didn't really have Serrano on that pedestal in terms of her overall ability. And if I was to ask the same question now and answer it, I see it as being pretty much a 50-50 fight. Like, it's probably gone from 80-20 to 50-50 in my mind. And the thing is, I don't believe that Amanda Serrano has improved drastically in the intervening couple of years. I think it's just that our old friend Father Time is beginning to catch up with a 35-year-old Katie Taylor. And there's no doubt in my mind that she's on the on a slight but very very obvious to my mind downward trajectory in her career, just a kind of a natural athletic decline. Serrano's at maybe 3-4 years younger, and is probably still just about at the peak of her power. So I think it's literally just a fact that age has narrowed the gap between them, and I genuinely believe it's a, actually, do you know what, if I said it, I think it's a 50-50 fight, I'd be lying. I think it's a 60-40 fight in Amanda Serrano's favour.
So how much of a risk then is it for Katie to take this fight? And I guess then on the flip side of that, does she need to take it to cement her place as the greatest?
Yeah, if she wants to be the greatest, I think she needs to take it. I don't think it's necessary to take it in order to cement a legacy. I mean, if she walked away right now, her legacy would be one of, it would be almost unparalleled, really, in professional boxing. Not just her CV, but what would certainly be unparalleled is the transcendent effect she has had on the sport, and the way in which she, with the support of Eddie Hearn and with the strategizing of Brian Peters and the help of Tomas Rowan, have sort of, I suppose, put women's boxing in a place where we're even talking about it, you know? Obviously, we on your show would always be talking about Katie Taylor no matter what she was doing, but just the fact that it's so widely accepted now as being part of boxing, you know, that would probably be her, I'd say that would be the greatest testament to her when she does walk away, whenever that may be, not the belts. But in terms of like taking the fight and the risk to her, I would say that there is a significant risk that if she loses the fight, people will perceive her to have been a little bit overrated, maybe a little bit overhyped. And I suppose the greatest jeopardy to it is that if she didn't avenge the defeat in a rematch, for example, it would probably follow her around for the rest of her life. I mean, that's the harsh reality of being a professional sports person, and certainly the harsh reality of being somebody who takes her sport as seriously as Katie Taylor. So the stakes really couldn't be higher on that front.
Also, just from a pure legacy and historical point of view, they are the first ever female fighters to headline a Madison Square Garden event. 140 years of boxing history, and they are going to be a big part of it from here on in.
Yeah, it's amazing. And just the idea of there being 20,000 people to watch a female headline event anywhere really in the world. I know, like Madison Square Garden, as you say, there is that sort of historical prestige to it, and it's a magnificent place to watch a fight. I've been lucky enough to be there myself for a few of them, but I think it's kind of like the extent to which this is going to be part of the mainstream boxing conversation and part of the mainstream sporting conversation in Ireland and in the UK as well, to an extent in America. It's just a legitimately massive fight. It's by far and away the biggest ever women's boxing match, right? But actually, if you look at 2022, it's just one of the biggest fights that can be made, male or female, in any combat sport. I really do believe it is that big, and I do believe it's going to be treated as such by media, by fans, by everybody. And there's just something a little bit special about somebody like Katie Taylor, who we as a country have appreciated for so long, being put on that type of pedestal, that type of platform. I mean, she's earned her place there, and for her to be appreciated by really a global audience is something to cherish, I think, as an Irish sports fan. And you just have to hope that there's a happy ending rather than some of my fears coming to fruition, I suppose, by the end of it.
Yeah, that's for sure. So I'm just reading the press release. So both fighters deserve great credit for getting this fight made, as does Jake Paul and his team at Most Valuable Promotions. I didn't realise he was involved.
yeah, the omnipresent and unavoidable Jake Paul. He's a YouTube sensation, in case anybody at home has a life, I suppose. He has a fledgling boxing career of his own now, of course. He's fought a couple of mixed martial artists and so on. He basically has been working. He began to train alongside Amanda Serrano for, I think, his fight with Ben Askren. So two fights ago for him, and I think two fights ago for her as well. And just was a little bit inspired by her dedication, her work ethic, got to know her, and basically has taken her under his wing to an extent in a kind of a managerial capacity. He has a company called Most Valuable Promotions, and they have negotiated on Serrano's behalf for this fight. And I think it's pretty, whether it's just circumstantial or coincidental or whatever, there's something to be said for the fact that this fight has been on the cards for 5 years, and this YouTuber, whether you like him or not, gets involved for a couple of months and suddenly the fight is on. Maybe he's better than we give him credit for.
I thought he was moving into MMA.
I'm not going to lie to you, Marie. You probably need an MMA correspondent or a Jake Paul correspondent to answer that for you. I'm not quite as up to speed on him as I should be, maybe.
Interest in Jake Paul. Anyway, we'll park Jake Paul and we'll go back to Katie Taylor. So she's going to be doing this massive fight. Do you think this is going to be it for her after this?
I would love to think that it would be if she won. I fear that it won't be, because I don't know that she has figured out yet what she would like to do after boxing, or at least if she has, she hasn't told us, which in fairness would be her right. But when you consider the degree to which boxing has been such a constant in her life, I mean, somebody said to me recently who knows her, and they didn't mean it as an insult at all, but she actually lives quite a boring life by anybody else's standards. From the outside looking in, she has her family, her friends, church, and boxing, and like, they're all absolutely sacred to her. But boxing probably takes up the most time, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's probably 60, 70% of her time. And if you equate that to just how much she's thinking about it as well, to remove that from her, like, it's just such an enormous vacuum and a void to fill. And I think that for as long as she can do it and for as long as she's winning, she probably will do it. I think that eventually there will come a time where it may take Brian Peters, it may take Eddie Hearn, although Eddie has told me on several occasions he will never have the conversation with her about stepping away, because he's actually too frightened to bring it up. But it may take everybody, her mother Bridget, her brother, like her sister. It's a very difficult conversation to have. I think there's an old saying that a boxer is, well, I'm paraphrasing, but a boxer is usually the last person to realize that it's no longer there. But somebody corrected me on that recently when I brought it up, and they said, no, it's not that they're the last person to realize it, it's that they're the last person to admit it. And that they probably know deep down when it's the athleticism is waning a little bit, and just the fire is gone. I think with Taylor, the fire will always be there. It's whether or not the limbs can keep up. And you just would love to see her walk away unblemished and most importantly, fit and healthy. I think that she will no matter what. But it's just whether or not that legacy will be intact to the same extent as well.
I'll always remember, I think it was probably the first lockdown, and you know, there was a lot of opportunity to interview sports people because everybody was doing nothing, and she made the point at some stage that what we were all experiencing in lockdown was actually just the way she lives her life. So we got a bit of an insight into it that time when we weren't able to go anywhere or do anything, that she was always so focused on her task, and that was to train really hard all the time and get prepared for fights, that she wasn't doing all the normal things that everybody else was doing. So I guess really, Gav, if this is it, then you know, we're never going to get that big day in Ireland then.
No, I don't think that'll ever happen, to be totally honest. You know, you could actually record a whole show, I suppose, on the reasons behind why. And as much as I'm kind of blue in the face from saying it or writing about it or whatever, it always feels as though there are a lot of people who kind of don't understand why. I suppose, like, the reality is that the climate in Dublin still isn't right for a major professional boxing event to take place there. And that's, to stress, those aren't my beliefs necessarily, but they're certainly the beliefs of the Gardaí and of the authorities that actually matter. And that will be an absolute crying shame if she does walk away one day without having fought in Ireland. I mean, people always say Dublin, she's from Wicklow, you know, but it just would be such a shame. Eddie Hearn acknowledges as much, but I mean, speaking to him in Liverpool quite recently, I sort of said to him, you know, can we just accept, or can you acknowledge that maybe actually Dublin isn't going to happen, instead of stringing people along and constantly saying, oh, you know, we've got to do it, we've got to do it. And he kind of quietly nodded, you know, he was kind of like, yeah, look, it's probably not. And you could see he felt as though it would be a shame as well. But it's just, it might just be one of those things. And as I say, there's probably a book, a podcast series in the exact reasons why it can't happen. But ultimately, as a result of gangland warfare, as a result of the Regency shooting in 2016, and all of these dots that are connected together, it's not feasible for the moment, and that remains the case.
Yeah, that is pretty unfortunate stuff. All right, Gav, as always, thank you so much for joining us. I'm looking forward to the next few months just talking about this.
Can't wait. Thanks, Marie.
Talk to you soon. Right, so much to look forward to there with that Katie Taylor and Amanda Serrano fight coming up on Saturday the 30th of April in Madison Square Garden. Looking like there's going to be a crowd of 20,000. It will be the place to be that weekend. Now, there's lots of other news going on today as well, and we're going to stick with our women, Shane. So Republic of Ireland defender Diane Caldwell has joined Manchester United. That is exciting.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great. We had yesterday Sinead Kavanagh, Liam McCourt today, Taylor Serrano, and now some more positive news in women's sports. So yeah, Republic of Ireland defender Diane Caldwell will be featuring in the Women's Super League in England. The 84-time capped Ireland international signed for Manchester United until the end of the season. The 33-year-old Dubliner spent last season playing alongside Denise O'Sullivan at North Carolina Courage in America, and she's also had spells in Germany, Iceland and Norway. So I know we were talking yesterday about Irish players going abroad and not exactly taking the most familiar route as well, but for any Manchester United fans and you know the worries that they've had that the players weren't playing for the shirt, she just tweeted in the last couple of minutes that words can't describe what this means to me. Everything I've done in my life was for this moment. As a lifelong United fan, it's a dream to sign for the club and a huge moment for me and my family. I'm so grateful to be here and will wear the badge with so much pride and passion. So she
said, that is actually class, because so many young girls, and like Diana's 33 now, would have grown up watching the Premier League and would have never thought in a million years that there was going to be an opportunity to go on and play for a Man United or a Liverpool or a Chelsea or an Arsenal or whoever it was. And for such a long time, Manchester United didn't have a women's team. They didn't back it, but they have now. And to see Diane getting that moment, she has spent such a long time travelling all around the world, trying to be a professional doing her utmost. It was her dream and she was determined to do it. And even when she would have started, there wouldn't have been pathways there for her. She would have had to go the long way around, as you pointed out there, travelling to many different countries centuries to follow that dream. So even just the fact that she is that lifelong Manchester United fan and she is getting that opportunity, that's my highlight of the day.
Yeah, absolutely. And just to note that even the reveal and the photo shoot was done in Old Trafford as well. So it's front and centre, and that's exactly what you want to see. So it's brilliant.
Yeah, well, good for her. And has been such an important player and dedicated player as well for the Ireland women's team. And hopefully we'll be seeing a little bit more of her now over the next few months. Any other transfer news while we're at it, Shane?
Well, I suppose you could say good news for an Irish player, Matt Doherty, because it looks like Adama Traore won't be going to join Spurs. He looks like he will be finally a deal with Barcelona either this evening or tomorrow. We might get some white smoke from the Catalan club. It looks like a loan with buy option for €30 million plus bonuses. Barca will cover 100% of the salary until June. So hopefully, if Spurs don't get their man, therefore Matt Doherty might get a look in with Antonio Conte. Other small bit of transfer news, Manchester United winger Amad Diallo has joined Rangers on loan, just for if we're keeping with the Manchester United news as well. But other news as well, if you go back to women's sport, and again, some great positive news is that TikTok has been confirmed as the inaugural title sponsor of the Women's Six Nations. The social networking service will also be an official partner to the men's Guinness Six Nations and an Autumn Nations series from the 2022 season right the way through to 2025. TikTok says it has amassed over 5 billion views for its rugby content on the platform and plans to ramp up its focus on the Women's Six Nations content this spring. On paper, it seems absolutely brilliant, but I will also be honest with you, Marie, I'm not on TikTok, so I'm not. These are numbers that I will believe. They're coming from trusted sources, but I might just be a bit old for TikTok,
yeah,
or I'm not sure.
Tell the truth now, you're one of those 5 billion, come on.
No, I don't even have Instagram, would you believe? No,
wow, I'm way behind.
I'm a staunch Twitter man, that's about it. Well, but no, yeah. On a serious note, it's brilliant, and it's going to have the Women's Six Nations front and centre. It's a really good sponsor to have, and again, you talk about promoting Diane Caldwell, promoting soccer to young girls, it's exactly what we'll do for women's rugby.
Well, Shane, you're full of good news today. We'll hang on to you for another while. Mm-hmm. Right, we're going to take a very quick break, and then it's time to preview the Allianz Leagues.
With Green Farm. Rise and grind and the hustle mindset aren't real. The protein in our chicken is. Get real.
Game on 2FM.
Now, welcome back. It is one of my favourite times of the year. The Allianz League is just around the corner and I am delighted to be previewing it in the company of former Sligo footballer Neil Ewing and also former Mayo footballer Austin O'Malley, and Shane Dawson of RT Sport is also along for the preview too. So there is plenty to get stuck into. Neil, I'm going to go to you first. Look, it's great to have you on today and so much to look forward to. And I think that the pre-season competitions have probably whetted our appetite because it's just fantastic to see so many people going to so many games and just the appetite there is now for these matches.
Hi Marie. Yeah, it's a hugely exciting time of the year. I suppose to start the National Leagues, there's always that buzz in every county across the country, but I think this year in particular, you mentioned that there are the pre-season competitions with the news we had just before last, again, restrictions lifting. I think it gave everybody a lift, prompted everybody to try and get out the games. And we've seen the big crowds last weekend, but I think you add into that mix then, you know, the great weather we've actually had this January, and I think you know, it probably feels even a little bit later in the year. So yeah, it's a great mix of restrictions being lifted, a decent spell of weather, and everybody getting the opportunity to get back out the games. It's really exciting, and I think you just look at the fixtures for this weekend and there's a few standout ones across all the divisions. So great to be building towards the weekend and have football back, and everybody have the option of either, you know, popping into their local town, getting to a game, or getting in the car with a group of friends and heading off to a game for the day.
Yeah, I don't think you can ask for anything more than that. And this year as well, Austin, it is quite, it is going to be quite condensed. It'll probably be over before we know it. And with the All-Ireland finals going to be on so much earlier, and just the fact that the championship is starting a little bit earlier, so that there isn't that kind of gap between the league and the championship anymore. Is there a bit of an onus now on teams to be getting things right from the start, because they're not going to have that time to improve in between?
Yeah, no, I think it is, and I think it's a really great point because it is condensed. So, like, the shadow boxing is kind of over now, and it's really teams really are looking forward to these kind of quality games to kind of see where they're at and kind of get a barometer on, I suppose, where collectively they're at and where different individuals are at. So, and again, for managers, it's a great opportunity to really sort of, you know, I suppose, ratchet things up earlier than normal, because that's going to be really, really important come, you know, as they navigate through those number of National League games, which will ideally set them up for Championship then.
You've obviously been in the thick of it as a player, Austin, and you've done a bit of coaching now. So if you have your manager's hat on, I suppose, how difficult is it to find that balance? Because it is, what, 7 games in 9 weeks, a 2-week break, and then you're in the Championship. So is it a case of, yes, you want to get game time into players, but also you need the momentum? How big a headache is that?
Well, it is. It's always a big concern, and it's always, you know, one that you have to scratch your head about and give a lot of thought to, because, you know, the National League or Division 1 in particular can be very unforgiving, and you know, you're trying to consolidate your place up there, but also you're trying to build and develop and grow maybe some new players coming in, and also maybe just get a feel in terms of where are some older guys, and if they're, you know, if they're still hungry enough and if they're still presenting and showing what you need. So it's definitely, like, it's a challenging time of year as well, because you're coming off the back of, you know, quite a, you know, a loading block, and you're trying to cram so much in and you're trying to get a feel for all of these things, and then you're maybe looking with one eye to the Championship and maybe one eye on the previous season in terms of what you've learned and you're trying to implement in. So there's a lot of, you have a lot of balls in the air.
Neil, more often than not, well, pandemics aside, the people that are at the latter stages of the Championship tend to come from Division 1. So there's always a huge focus on it, and look, it's where teams want to be because it's where they get the challenges that they need to prepare for the latter stages of Championship, and ultimately they would hope that they would go on and be contesting for the Sam Maguire. So if we look at the teams that are up there, one that really intrigues me, and it's because they have come back to the pack, is Dublin. And I feel still heading into this season, Desi Farr in charge, that we don't really know a huge amount about where they're at. Would you agree?
Yeah, it's an interesting one for Dublin. And to be honest, I personally think they were written off too quickly by people after that Mayo game last year. You know, if you look back on where Dublin were at, you know, they went through the league. Obviously, there was no league final played, but they were, you know, one of the top two teams in the league, shared that Division 1 league title with Kerry. Now, yeah, you could argue that they stumbled through Leinster a little bit, but, you know, they were still winning games reasonably comfortable. In that semi-final against Mayo, they were, you know, what, maybe 6 points up at one stage. It was a game they looked to be cruising in, and, you know, at half-time or probably 5-10 minutes in the second half, you would have said Dublin are going to waltz the victory here. I think it was just a little bit of a freakish game, that Dublin-Mayo semi-final last year. You know, Mayo got themselves back into a game, but again, it took a retake in 45 by Robbie Henley with the last kick of the game for Mayo to bring the game into extra time. All the momentum was with Mayo. You know, fair play to Mayo. It was a spectacular win of the day and a great victory for them. But I think 9 times out of 10, Dublin would have came out the winners in that game. They would have went into the final. You would have fancied them to beat Tyrone, and, you know, you'd probably be having a different conversation now. Maybe you would be talking about a 7 in a row rather than a Dublin finish. But, you know, I think there's definitely another kick in this Dublin team. You know, a few players have stepped away, but the quality of player that Dublin have, they only need maybe one or two young players coming through all the time. You know, they're not like maybe other counties where you need, you know, a strong minor team that you're going to get 5 or 6 guys from. But, you know, Dublin, you know, I fancy them for the league, I fancy them for Leinster, and I fancy them for the All-Ireland this year. You know, you can even see the likes of Lee Gannon coming in there. They have those players there in the background ready to step up. So, yeah, for me personally, I think they've been written off far too quickly, and I'd be very surprised if they're not celebrating in All-Ireland later this year.
Right, well, we'll be holding you to that. Mm-hmm. Austin, that's really interesting. Like, it's such a rare thing to say about Dublin in this modern era that they are written off too soon. But when you look at the way Desi approaches the pre-season competitions, he does use them to try out new players. There are gaps there. People have stepped away. What are the areas do you think that he needs to replenish? Like, where would he have concerns now when he looks at a potential start in 15?
Yeah, I suppose in Dublin, again, like, you probably look at their defence, I would say, in that full back line, in terms of, I think they can be got at. and particularly when they're isolated in one-on-one positions. So I think maybe, you know, they've played for years in terms of maybe having a bit of a screen and two sitting in front and that. And the game is developing on, and we've seen that it's beginning to come a little bit more open and that. So I really do think that within that full back line, there are definitely areas that they can be got at. When you're looking at, I suppose, around maybe even at a Kerry and in terms of the artillery that they might have up there, you know, Dublin need to probably, I think, start developing these kind of negators, these, you know, one-on-one real defensive guys that can take guys out of a game. You know, if an opposition push up and they pull those sweepers out of it, that guys get isolated. And now I know it's easy to say that, and that takes a bit of work. But I think that, but look, going back to Dublin, they're if you look at the drive shaft of the team, it's still really solid. Like when you look at Fintan, Con O'Callaghan, you know, James McCarthy, Cooper, Dean Rock, these guys, like, that's a serious, serious kind of drive shaft. So it's only minor tweaks. I actually think they're going to come and be in some ways re-energised from last year, because it's kind of an acid test now. Like, they've been rolling so long that they've got a little bit of a kick. There's a sting in it. And I can only imagine internally in the Dublin dressing room. And, you know, it's very easy to motivate these guys come pre-season now that, you know, they've been, you know, there's been a slice taken of them. Let's see the reaction now. And I think they'll probably, and I'd say Desi will use that as well, you know.
Yeah, I think Desi will have to have that kind of siege mentality. And I've watched him in the O'Byrne Cup, and yes, I appreciate there's only so much you can take out of McGrath or an FDB League or a McKenna Cup and indeed the O'Byrne Cup, but there seems to be a new style that Desi is seemingly to try and implement, and they're really smothering the ball a lot more and getting that first collision. But I think how some teams tried to combat that in the O'Byrne Cup was trying to just go a bit more direct, and we've seen them, Dublin, being suspected that when teams go direct at them, that perhaps we haven't seen in that six in a row team, because I think their defensive solidity is something that probably goes uncredited somewhat. But if, as Neil said, if you do take away the couple of players that have stepped away, you do have Lee Gannon, Bugler coming in, Tom Lahiff, Patrick Quiffick-Byrne, Akula, who's done tremendous, and I think he's real potential to be a formidable midfield partnership with Brian Fenton there. So there are players to plug those few gaps. But if we're to develop the conversation, Austin, and say, look at Tyrone, for example, so there they are, All-Ireland champions, and yes, they have the monkey off the back of getting over the line in that. But when you have a monkey off the back, you also now have a target on your back. And in terms of players coming through there, I mean, Tiernan McCann is, what, the fifth Tyrone player now to opt out for 2022. There'll be no Ronan O'Neill, Mark Bradley, Hugh Pat McGeary, Michael Cassidy. And yes, I appreciate they're still exceptionally talented players working under exceptionally talented management. But do you feel that that might hamper Tyrone going into this year because of the couple of players that have stepped away?
Yeah, no, when you take that amount of sort of football intelligence and leadership and know-how and capability off the table, it undoubtedly will hurt an outfit. The flip side to that, I suppose, as a manager, you're looking at Tyrone football, it's a very strong, you know, club football, and there is a lot of quality around it. So I suppose the challenge for the guys is, can they bring, you know, a couple of other guys in that will, you know, maybe bring a little bit more energy, a little bit more enthusiasm and so on. But the guys that have stepped away, they're all big characters, they're all big leaders, and as I said, a lot of football intelligence has left that dressing room as well. And you're coming on the back of winning in All-Ireland, which is it's always a difficult thing, as you alluded to previously. You have a target on your back. Like, will they even get out of Ulster? It's a minefield, you know. So it'll be very, very interesting. But they have two exceptional guys managing them and leading the line. So I wouldn't be surprised if you still see them there at the latter stages, you know.
Interestingly, we had Mark McHugh on last night, Neil, and he was talking about Tyrone. And look, we mentioned them chipping the six goals against Kerry, and then they beat the Donegal team, and what he noted was that they just seemed to get better as the championship went on. They kept improving, they were getting more on top with their brief. They have that style of play now where pretty much everybody, maybe bar one player up front, is really adaptable, attacking, defending, and a lot of teams are going to be looking at that and trying to mirror that in ways, or at least try and find ways to counter it. But it must be pretty frightening for other teams when you hear a player like McHugh just saying how they were getting better at what they were doing with every passing month. And we know we're now another few months on, they've obviously been on a break, but if they continue on that trajectory, like, it is you know, the world is their oyster almost.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I've long admired Tyrone for what they were able to achieve. I think, you know, they were a team that played above themselves for a few years there and probably even got criticised for that because they weren't winning All-Irelands. But this, you know, this was at a time when Dublin were dominating. I think it was interesting last year, obviously, Brian Duer and Fergal Logan got back involved. But I think it was also interesting that Peter Donnelly was back involved with that team. And, you know, he's had his fingerprints on a lot of success at club level in Tyrone, but also for Tyrone at intercounty level, even Cavan at under 21 level as well. And you know, that running game that they play, they're just phenomenal at it. And you know, they probably don't have the athletes that, you know, maybe Dublin have around that middle eight, or Mayo have around that middle eight, similarly Kerry. So they have to play a different type of game. But yeah, it's a type of game that, you know, if you can get a run on the team, summer championship football, very hard to stop that momentum. And they obviously have the finishers up front then, you know, who can be lethal on their day if they get the proper supply. So but I think Austin touched on it there. Will they come out of Ulster? And you know, I don't think there's any guarantee on that at all. Even last year, I know they won the All-Ireland, but I wouldn't have them down as probably the best team in the country, and that's not to slight them. You know, they did fantastically well to win the All-Ireland, but I think you know, Dublin and Kerry are probably the two best teams in the country. But you know, Tyrone, just that little bit of doggedness in that semi-final last year against Kerry. You know, Kerry had the disallowed goal. Tyrone even probably beaten going into the last 5 minutes. Derek Hanneman's goal chance is saved, the rebound comes to Tyrone, man. You know, they pick it off, and you know, then in the final they were able to go on and probably just overrun Mayo just by those transitional footballers they had throughout the field. And you know, maybe it sounds you know, a bit of jargon, but really what they have is a lot of transitional players. They have a few man markers, a few finishers up front, and you know, probably 12 players who could play anywhere on the pitch outside of that then. So it's going to be interesting to see how they go. They probably got a wake up call there in the McKenna Cup, but you know, to get out of Ulster, very challenging. You know, I'd even fancy Derry are coming there, Donegal, Monaghan, they'll challenge Tyrone. But the other thing for Tyrone is they won't have any fear of a backdoor. And you know, the fact the backdoor is in this year, they're the type of team that could be very dangerous even if they don't win an Ulster Championship.
Well, I was crediting Mark McHugh with those comments when it's actually Ryan that we had on yesterday. So Tyrone are going to play Monaghan this weekend, and then it is Donegal versus Mayo. So we probably will know a little bit more about where Ulster football is at after the weekend. We'll also probably know a little bit more, Austin, about where Mayo are at too. Look, obviously great news that Oisín Mullen is now going to be sticking around. Like, great news for the team themselves, but even just for the county to have that boost, it'll kind of nearly rejuvenate things again.
Absolutely, like it was palpable down west, you know, when the news came through, you know, just even through Castlebar and into Westport or any of the town, you know, it was a hot topic of conversation. You know, he's been iconic over the last 2 years, you know, Young Footballer of the Year back to back, and I think it's just the style and I suppose the raw physicality and also married with skill level that he brings to the game, you know, and he's developed into a real leader for Mayo and a real clutch player. In his first All-Ireland 2 years ago, you know, we've seen that, you know, he pushed up, he was on Conor Callan for that first half and he'd done quite well. So he's a guy that you know, Mayo would be looking to build a kind of a defence around. I still think we might be struggling in terms of where his best position is. He's so athletic, he's so physically robust, and he's such a good ball carrier, and he's such a good guy to get us on the front foot and get us up the field. And, you know, unfortunately, last year he got pinned back at, I think it was in cornerback, or full, you know, he was picking up Cathal McShane for that goal. But I just think we need him probably somewhere out, you know, spending most of his time in that middle third. That's where he gives us real oxygen and energy going forward.
Also great to see Jason Doherty, first appearance in 2.5 years, years back with Mayo. Neil, I hear Austin chatting there and he's referring as Mayo as we, so you might give a more impartial viewpoint here of where do you feel Mayo are at the moment? Is it a case of the ship has sailed, it's a new generation, or is there an All-Ireland in them? It's this perennial question that I just, where are Mayo?
Yeah, I'm never going to get the impartial view from Austin on Mayo, but I don't think the ship has sailed on Mayo, to be fair to them. I actually think probably when James Horan came back in, he's probably got the two All-Ireland finals that he probably never expected to. You know, he really has taken on a project to reshape that team. You can see a lot of the guys that would have competed, say, from 2012 to 2017-18 have moved on. And James Horan, you know, you can see the transformation he's tried to make in that he's brought in a very definite type of player into the team. It's guys who are very, very strong athletically. You know, you even look at Owen McLaughlin there at wing back. You know, I think he was probably better known as a cyclist until James Horan got his hands on him and really moulded him. You have Oisín Mullen, you know, phenomenal athletes. So I think James Horan identified when he came back in that to compete with Dublin, you need to be able to take them on 15-on-15. To take Dublin on 15-on-15, not only do you need to have good footballers, but you need to have guys who are good athletes and can get up and down the pitch and compete with Dublin in that respect. So I think he's started to introduce them over the last 2 years. He's done a great job introducing them. And I think probably James Horan would have felt it was probably this year three and year four of his second term before they will be competing for All-Ireland. So I'm excited to see where they're going to go with this year, especially, you know, Kieran O'Connor is going to be back as well. He's probably going to feel like a new player for them after missing him last year on their run to the final. So, I don't think it's unfounded optimism from Austin. You know, you fancy them to, even if they don't come out of Connacht, that they're going to be involved in the last four regardless. And also probably another thing in their favour is that if they do win the Connacht Championship, they'll avoid Dublin and Kerry in the All-Ireland semi-final. So, you know, they may only have to take one big scalp to win in All-Ireland this year. So unfortunately, as a Sligo man, there is some optimism for Mayo.
I'd say there's a lot of counties, Austin, at the moment at this time of year sitting around feeling quite optimistic about what the next few months will hold. And one of them will probably be Kerry, Jack O'Connor down there. And look, you know, this time of year we're seeing David Clifford doing unbelievable things at college level, and just knowing as well that they do have a huge amount of talent, but they still need to make some gains though.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, in terms of just looking what Jack O'Connor already has done in terms of the McGrath Cup, he's set his stall out, you know, quite, I suppose, robust from the start in terms of what he is named. And like, and even looking at what he's brought back in, or he seems to have the ability to reinvigorate the likes of Paul Gainey, 1-4 last week. So you can see Jack's mentality already that he wants to hit the ground running. He's getting these guys, he's getting games into the Merley doors. Like, they're heading for Newbridge the weekend there, and I would fully suspect them to come through that. But I think the biggest thing, probably looking at Kerry from last year, and I know he'll probably have gone hard and fast after, is really locking that defence together. Like, they were quite porous last year. They got turned quite a bit against Tyrone. If you watched, look back over that game in terms of the amount of time Kerry defenders were turning, chasing the ball instead of facing it, was something that would have been alarming. So, like, in terms of locking that six together, they have all the ammunition and the gelignite up front to win numerous All-Irelands, but it's about getting that back six together really nailed down. And, you know, a centre back, he's Tadhg Morley in there. You know, he has Tom Sullivan, who had spent a lot of time up the field last year and over the last couple of years. Maybe they need to just lock that defence down, keep these six at home, and maybe even getting those wing players back in, helping out a little bit more again. And then that transition to that quick ball up front to Paddy Clifford and David Clifford and Gainey and these guys. So, you know, Jack, he's it all done in the game. He's one of the most respected figures within the game. And, you know, I'm just sure that from the younger Kerry players coming through, they're only delighted to be back under his tutelage again, in terms of either some of them at minor prior to that as well. So, yeah, I'd say it'll be a fruitful period for Kerry going down the line.
There is also the addition of Stephen O'Cunbar as well coming into that Kerry side. So, you know, that's certainly a big
positive.
And
Dylan Casey there as well, waiting in the wings, a potential fullback for a decade ahead of him, really, if they can mould him into what they need him.
Absolutely. He is really showing up in club football with Stacks, and he looks like he's got a lot about him. And I'm sure he'll be fast track, because it definitely is an area that Kerry have been short a little bit in the last number of years.
It's interesting that obviously Jack O'Connor going in, and he's been there, he's done that, he's won trophies in the past, and he knows that. How do you think the relationship between Jack's style and also Paddy Talley coming in the more defensive kind of mindset, trying to put manners on the Kerry defence, how do you think that's going to match up throughout this league campaign and indeed into the championship?
Yeah, I think it's a really, really astute move by Jack bringing Paddy in. You know, we obviously know Paddy in terms of what he brings, in terms of that defensive style of football, and getting guys really solid, really cohesive, and getting them facing the play, as I said, rather than chasing the play. So I think it was a really, really good move. It's an area that Kerry probably haven't addressed over the last number of years, and it has hurt them. So it's a real flare being sent up by Jack in terms of probably the approach that they're going with. So he's a great addition, and obviously, you know, as we said it, you know, on previous show on this show previously, he has a fingerprints over an awful lot of college football and intercounty football, and the style that he brings in terms of, you know, Tyrone going back in the noughties and that as well. So
yeah, I think it says an awful lot about what he wants to achieve bringing him in. But it's going to be an absolute cracking first game, Neil. So they're going to be facing against Kildare. Obviously Jack O'Connor was at the helm there when he moved on to Kerry, and Kildare have now added Paul Galvin as well to their backroom team. So every narrative that we could possibly need is right there for us.
Yeah, absolutely. That one's been scripted nearly, and I think it's even better again that it's taking place in Newbridge. I don't know, there's something about that ground in Newbridge. I don't know if it's the raised stand or there's a nice little atmosphere that can build in it. And obviously Kildare have their dream team management. You know, if you're any Kildare supporter or you know, any young player in Kildare, you know, you're going to be itching to get out and play for Glenn Ryan, Dermot Early and Johnny Doyle. And then you add in the fact that your manager who left in, I suppose you could say, quite controversial circumstances last year is coming back in the first game. Yeah, it's teed up to be you know, a tinderbox atmosphere come throwing there on Sunday. You know, I think for Kildare, while, you know, the script is brilliant and the narratives are all there, it's probably not the best game that they would have liked to start the league with. You know, this Kerry team with probably a lot to prove, who want to hit the ground running this year and show that they're All-Ireland contenders. So probably not the game Kildare would have wanted to start the league with, but in terms of atmosphere and narrative, yeah, it's going to be huge. And then I'm quite surprised that Kildare did bring Paul Galvin in along with the, you know, the three, and I suppose there's no other word for it, but three Kildare legends that they have. But even the timing that he's come in, you know, just a little bit later in the year, you know, a lot of things would have probably been back preparing since October, November, that, you know, it's maybe something that they've spotted over the last number of weeks that they felt there's a gap. So, you know, fair play to Glenn Ryan and his management team if they've, I suppose, had the maturity to look at what they have and what they don't have and look outside the box for somebody who can fill a gap for them. So, yeah, that adds to the narrative this again, though, as you say.
I think, Marie, just before we do wrap up, I don't think we've focused enough on Armagh. Kieran Donaghy might be giving it. We had him on earlier in the show. They're facing Dublin and Croke Park, I know, and it's going to be such an exciting team for Armagh. And just from a personal viewpoint, it's a repeat of the 2002 All-Ireland semi-final, which I think many Dublin fans still have a heavy heart about, especially for someone who's grown up in the shadow of Croke Park.
Are you going to go?
I am. It's my first weekend, brilliant. Free from working. We are all talking about fans being back at matches, Croke Park, and the Walsh Cup final is on beforehand at 5:30. So a great weekend of GEA as the Allianz League started. And Marie, I cannot wait.
Well, you better come back in next week now and tell us all about it. Neil, thank you so much for joining us. Osti, the same. It's been a pleasure. Really enjoyed that and really looking forward to the weekend as well. We've had a few texts in. One reminded me that we need to be starting to talk about Clare and the Sam Maguire in the same conversation. Not today, but maybe after the league campaign we might do that.
Okay, is that yourself texting in, Marie? all this Clare narrative being thrown around.
I just wrote that up myself.
That was cherry picked beautifully out of the
right, we better take a break and we're back with NFL.
Game on 2FM with Green Farm. Being flat to the mat isn't real. Our protein is Get Real.
Game on 2FM.
Welcome back. It is now time for our American sports slot, and I'm delighted to say that Jeff Shepherd joins us on the line. Shep, it's the time of the year when we are starting to get retirements, and one that has come up is just before we came on air, Ben Roethlisberger of the Pittsburgh Steelers has retired after 18 seasons. He'll be a bit of a loss to the game.
Absolutely. Look, Marie, I mean, look, this is about the worst kept secret in American football, you know, over the last couple of months. He's been really banged up. And I mean, he's a, you know, his nickname's Big Ben. He's a real big guy. And, you know, he's taken a lot of big hits over his career. He doesn't really get regarded as one of the all-time greats, but think about this. He's got two Super Bowl wins. The problem is he plays in Pittsburgh, and Terry Bradshaw has four, so he's always going to kind of be in that shadow. But he's in the top five in passing yards and games won. He's an absolute future Hall of Famer, no doubt whatsoever. So, yeah, I mean, the Steelers are going to – I mean, think about this. For the first time in really 20, you know, almost two decades, they're going to have to figure out – who's their quarterback? And that's a great luxury to have. You're talking about, like, you know, the Patriots and Brady and the Saints with Breeze when you talk about situations like that, you know?
So we're going to just, enough about Ben now. I need to talk about Aaron Rodgers. It's been a couple of weeks now. Are we going to have a saga for the foreseeable with everybody trying to guess whether or not he is going to be leaving Green Bay?
So, I mean, it'd be weird if we didn't have a saga, obviously, sure, as we've chronicled for the last year, you know? I just don't know. I mean, after watching that game last week and kind of Saturday night and how they lost, God, I just find it hard to believe that he's going to be coming back there. And they've got a lot of salary cap issues, you know. You can only spend so much on players and different things. I mean, they're going to lose a lot of their very best players just simply because of the economics of the game. And he even kind of mentioned that in his post-game remarks, that he thought it was going to be different there next year, regardless of whether or not he's there. I mean, obviously it's different if he leaves. But, I mean, you know, so I don't know if it's going to get dragged out. It's going to be a hard situation. I don't think anybody, you know, it's not a trade situation. But if he decides to sign somewhere, you know, for a year or two and then retire, it wouldn't be shocking. A lot of signs, as you know, mm-hmm, have kind of been pointing to that over the last 12 months.
Yeah, that's for sure. Okay, so we do have action this weekend, though,
yes,
Shep. So there is on-field stuff going on. So tell us, what can we look forward to over tuning in to the NFL?
All right, real quick. So, your Super Bowl spots are on the line this weekend. On Sunday, we've got the Bengals and the Chiefs, Joe Burrow and Ja'Marr Chase and the upstart Bengals taking on the veteran Patrick Mahomes. He's been like 5 years in the league now. But, you know, the Chiefs looking to play in their third straight Super Bowl. Both teams are 4-1 in their last five games. And Marie, the Chiefs' lone loss was to the Bengals in Cincinnati in week 17, and Burrow threw for 450 yards. Ja'Marr Chase had more receiving yards than Patrick Mahomes had passing yards in the game. So I think there's going to be a lot of points scored in that game. And then Sunday evening, for the third time this season, San Francisco and the Los Angeles Rams. The reason why they're playing again is because San Francisco beat LA in week 18 in overtime in Los Angeles. And so it's crazy that these two teams are playing each other, but the Niners have beaten the Rams quite a bit in recent years. The winner advances to the Super Bowl. The Rams looking to be the second team to host the Super Bowl on their home field after the Buccaneers did it last year.
All right. Well, so give us your picks then.
I think it's going to be really hard for Cincinnati to go in and go beat the Chiefs, as much as I love my Joe Burrow because of, you know, his play at LSU. I just think the Chiefs at home, after what we saw Sunday night in that Bills game, which was incredible, I think they're going to be really tough to beat. So I'm going to pick the Chiefs there. And I'm going to go with the 49ers. They are just kind of on a mission right now. They're playing really good football. I know they didn't score a lot of points. They didn't score actually any points last week on offense or defense. It was a special teams touchdown in Green Bay. But they are locked and loaded. And Kyle Shanahan, the coach for San Francisco, seems to have Sean McVay's number in Los Angeles. And so I think the Niners win another very close football game.
Okay, Shep, thank you so much. I love that phrase, locked and loaded. Well, we are locked and loaded and ready to finish up because that is all we have time for. Tara Kumar is up next.
Game on UFF. With Green Farm. Being up to 90 isn't real. The protein in our range is. Get real.